Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We've got a studio full of experts, insiders, ready to talk about the issues of the day. And we also have, in fact, I'll start with you, Tamar Hallerman, who is the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's correspondent on Capitol Hill. Thanks for joining us today, Tamar.
Thanks for having me.
I can't even imagine how you made your way out of the Capitol. It's so busy up there. And we'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. Your colleague, Greg Bluestein, a political reporter for the AJC, is with us as well. You were here at GPB yesterday to watch the mayoral debate that we staged yesterday afternoon. We want to get into that with you at some point today.
Yeah, 2 days in a row. And I caught the Kathy Willard event last night.
Yeah, we're going to talk. There's some news there that we'll talk about in a few minutes. Theron Johnson, Democratic political consultant. He worked for President Obama in the reelection campaign. He ran his campaign in the Southeast. He's worked with everyone from Kasim Reed to John Lewis. So you've got a great portfolio for working with political leaders.
I'm truly blessed.
Okay, thank you. And I'm really happy, Todd Ream, Republican consultant, also the guy who puts out thanks for that we all thank him for every day, GeorgiaPundit.com. And Todd, you know, one of the things, excuse me, I like about Georgia Pundit, and I think I've said it on the show before, is you give us big stories, but you're one of those people, you really pay attention to what's happening in local government, too. And that's such a wonderful thing, because not many people do.
Thank you very much. A lot of times, if you're paying attention to the city councils and the county commissions, you can see what's going to be coming 6 or 12 months ahead.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the things Georgia Pundit does so well. So thanks for being here, Todd. Tomorrow, we're not going to go into it in great detail until a little later in the show, but clearly all the action up there all this week has been in the Senate as they scramble to get this tax bill passed by the end of the week. Can you give us a scene setter? Just tell us, how does it feel up there right now? Is everybody sort of rushing around with their, like chickens with their heads cut off? Are they methodically working toward this? What's the atmosphere?
It was very frenzied and around the clock as leaders are trying to shore up support. But now it feels like this thing really has momentum, and we could start seeing votes as soon as this afternoon. So things are really starting to pick up.
Well, okay, then let's talk about that for a minute. That's interesting. Are we going to see, is there going to be a voterama on this thing? Has the majority leader declared there will be one? And are you talking about that starting today?
No. Yes and no. So later this afternoon, if Republican leaders get their ducks in a row, they're going to have a procedural motion.
Right.
So they need to secure enough votes, and it's unclear that they have that at the moment. Once they do, we begin 20 hours of debate on the Senate floor, and only then do we do Votorama. So if everything happens according to plan, that'll be tomorrow night.
Okay, thank you. That makes sense. They do have to have the procedural votes in place first. So we're going to talk about that in a little more detail in a little while. But, you know, we've been starting with national news a lot on the show lately, and for good reason, because there's been a lot to talk about, especially where you are tomorrow. But let's take a few minutes. There's some interesting stories. They're not the most significant stories that are happening in terms of the governor's race, but they're fascinating. Greg Bluestein, Stacey Abrams, Democratic candidate for governor, gave an extended interview to Cosmopolitan magazine in which she suggested that she's got a long-range strategy to run for president of the United States. Were you surprised to see her say that so openly as she's running for governor?
I'm not surprised that Stacey Abrams has ambitions to run for the White House. I am surprised she admitted it. The normal conventional political strategies, you'd only talk about the race you're running now, not the race you want to run in the future. And, you know, there's lots of Republicans who might have an eye on the White House down the road, too. And if any of them had said that, we would have made a big story about it, too. In this case, Stacey Abrams not only said it, but she said she had a sort of an Excel sheet that she mapped out as a young woman, that her eventual goal was to eradicate poverty. And to do that, it meant running for state house, running for governor, trying out solutions to eradicate poverty as governor, and then running for the White House one day. And she made it very clear that 2028 is one of her goals.
Theron, the quote from Cosmopolitan that we have is, she said this, but I think once I've figured it out, once we've tested, talking about her plan for eradicating poverty and the like, and we've made sure the models work, once you've been able to work with the other 49 states and the territories to figure out what can make the most sense, I think then it makes sense to think about the next job. I got to say, visionary thinking on her part.
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that Stacey Abrams has never lacked, and that is ambition. I totally agree with Greg. I mean, it's just very unorthodox that at a time where you have a job, and I've learned in politics, is that you don't start focusing on your next political job while you currently are doing the job that you're in, because you'll lose the job that you're in focusing on the next job. And so, listen, I think that Stacey Abrams has, from the inception of her campaign, tried to raise her national profile. I think this is an interview that she genuinely wanted to talk about eradicating poverty. But I think that it also kind of paints a narrative that we all have kind of discussed, that she's trying to really break through some very tough barriers by becoming the first African-American woman to ever be governor. But to then say, hey, I want to run and be in the White House one day in 2028 is just, you know, it's just very ambitious.
Todd?
Well, if you walk down the street a few blocks to the building with the gold roof, you can walk around and everybody there who is a member of the Senate or the House, in their mind on a slow day, will be churning through the ideas of what it'll be like when they run for president. It's the way that those of us who aren't running for office think about what we'll do with our lottery winnings when we've just given our couple bucks to the Hope Scholarship Fund. So it's not the ambition that surprises me about Stacey Abrams. It's that what I've seen over the last few years is a rare combination of discipline and intelligence, and it's the relentless discipline that she brings to the job that's in front of her. If you think back, going at least back to 14, she has played the national Democratic behind the curtains game at a masterful level, with her New Georgia project, with putting together an ability to put together large sums of other people's money from Democratic donors at the national level. And this seems like the next almost inevitable step as she becomes, I think she's poised to become sort of a thought leader within Democratic politics.
Yeah, Tamar, though, if I were her opponent, Stacey Evans, I might try to make as much as I can out of her being more focused on her national profile than what she's going to do as governor of Georgia. That may not be, in fact, an accurate attack, but it's one that I think I'd level. Brian Kemp, Republican candidate for governor, has already gone after. He's raising money around it. He said, you know, send me $100 if you want somebody who's focused on Georgia, not on politics in Washington. So it's interesting, Tamar, to think about how the strategy plays. Some will admire her vision. Others will wonder where her head is.
Exactly. And that's an attack you see all the time. Well, if they're talking to the Washington Post or the New York Times or all these national outlets, that means they're not spending time in Georgia. You can argue whether that's a real thing or not, but that certainly is a criticism that we're starting to see more.
So the race is very young, and we haven't really had a lot to talk about in terms of it recently. And we're heading into, and we're in the holiday season already. Is there anything, Theron? Is there any kind of status report about the Democratic side of things right now?
Yeah, and one thing I want to say in defense of Stacey Abrams, I think there's nothing wrong in 2017 while raising your national profile and showing a level of competency and saying that you're ambitious. So I think that, you know, we're all kind of having this response about it because, I mean, let's just face it, she's not only an African-American, but she's an African-American woman talking about maybe running for president one day. While let's not forget, we did have African-American male become president of Barack Obama. But, you know, that's not really a lot going on. I mean, Stacey Evans came out and made a pretty bold endorsement for Keisha Lance Bottoms. I know we're going to talk about the mayor's race here in a minute. There is some rumblings that Stacey Abrams has been reached out to by both candidates and that she's considering maybe getting involved in some type of way, maybe in a group sort of way around a women's issue. So that's breaking news for you, Greg. I think that the fact still remains. If you look at what's going on in this country, if you look at what just happened over in Birmingham and other certain areas, I mean, a African-American candidate that fits the profile of a Stacey Abrams is in a very, very good position to really bring a unorthodox, untraditional way of campaigning to.
Are you committing to either of the gubernatorial candidates? Are you going to work for
other? I like both Stacey's. I mean, I think both of them are great leaders and they're energetic. And I think that whoever emerges as the nominee will be very fortunate.
I think a lot of what's happening right now, too, is just the behind-the-scenes groundwork. The candidates have gone all over the state. They've been quietly meeting at county parties. They've also been making trips, fundraising trips. Stacey Abrams was in New York and in California earlier this season. I think Stacey Evans right now is in Washington, D.C. to meet with folks. So they're raising money, and they're also putting their teams together. Stacey Evans has just hired a range of consultants and folks to help back her campaign up. She had a shoestring operation before, and Stacey Abrams is also rounding out her campaign. So a lot of it's the groundwork that we're going to see a lot more of January and beyond, and raising that money.
I can't speak to the Democratic side, but on the Republican side, we're basically waiting for the year-end reports.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to show some things about how is someone like a Clay Tippins, is he getting any traction with other folks? Is he ready to tip his hand and show how much money he's going to be put in? The big question, I think, for most Republicans is who can compete with Casey Cagle?
Yeah.
Is one of the other candidates going to be in a position where they can say that they are clearly the competition to what has quickly become, I think, a presumed front runner?
Yeah.
There's a couple big questions in that Republican fundraising that Todd just talked about, too. Is Clay Tippins a credible candidate?
Who, by the way, is about as unknown as a gubernatorial candidate can get.
An uncle who's a state senator, so there's a little bit of name recognition there. But he's a kind of low-profile businessman who just announced his campaign a few weeks ago that he's formally in the race. Also, a lot of people will be looking at those fundraising reports to see if there's still an opening for someone else to get in. My colleague Kyle Wingfield wrote a column about maybe Doug Collins jumping in the race. Maybe is there an opening for him? And I'm told that's not a random thought, that there actually could be a chance that someone like
Doug Collins. So make sure that listeners who do not follow, people who have been in elected office but are no longer there, tell everybody who Doug Collins is.
Doug Collins, just like Governor Deal, is a congressman, Republican congressman from Gainesville, who actually took Governor Deal's spot in Congress, representing a huge swath of North Georgia. It's one of the most conservative districts in the Eastern Seaboard. And he has been working to raise his profile quietly, but he has all over the state. He has, met with media folks all over the state. He's taking he's taking a proactive role in Washington. I think he's the fifth ranking Republican in the U.S. House
tomorrow.
Now.
Yeah.
So he is someone who, might just take a page from Governor Deal's playbook and use the same strategy Governor Deal used to emerge as the House member running for governor, if this happens.
Tamar, what do you say about Doug Collins up there? What kind of profile does he have?
Sure. I mean, he's certainly been growing it over the last few years. He really hasn't been here all that long. I believe he was elected only in 2012. But
yeah, that's why I wondered how many people might really even be aware of him at
this
point.
I mean, now he's the fifth ranking Republican. Yeah. There was talk when Kathy McMorris Rodgers, the number four, was being considered for a cabinet post that he could move up. So his star has really risen.
Yeah, I meant among voters statewide here, but I get that he's making a mark up there right now, right?
Yeah, and there's thought that maybe there could be room for him politically in the race, or at least maybe there's hope, that there is. I mean, Governor Nathan Neal's people and Greg, you can probably speak to this better. They haven't really jumped in on this race all that much. So there's room there. The delegation from Congress hasn't really jumped in all that much. So I think there's hope that somebody could jump in and consolidate support.
And I think there's still room for a self-funding candidate on the Republican side, depending on what Tippins looks like he's going to be willing to invest. I think that lane still exists for somebody else.
So five leading Republicans might not be enough.
Let me turn to, again, it's not one of the major headlines in the governor's race, but it is an interesting story. Greg, we know that all of the announced Republican candidates have signed a pledge that they will sign, if elected, a religious liberty bill that will protect individuals whose religious beliefs don't encourage them to deal with gay and lesbians in business dealings and whatever. We all know the Supreme Court, I think, next week takes up the cake case out of Colorado, the baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. But, okay, so they've all signed the pledge. We know the Religious Liberty Bill is going to come back yet again, a fourth session that it'll be brought to both bodies. But Kemp, who is about as conservative a candidate as you can get, has said that he wants a clean adoption bill, meaning that he will not support efforts that were made last year to add a provision to a bill to encourage more adoptions in Georgia that would allow adoption agencies to refuse to give babies to
same-sex couples.
Yeah, that's sort of an odd, it's interesting that he would take that position.
Yeah, this was kind of a shrewd move by Secretary of State Brian Kemp. I think there's a growing consensus on both sides of the aisle, in both chambers in the legislature, that they will very quickly pass this clean adoption bill. It's a top priority for Governor Deal and for Speaker Ralston, and I think Senate leaders are coming to terms with the fact that Governor Deal might hold other bills hostage or veto them if they come before him before this bill. So it's a priority for both Governor and Speaker Ralston, and I think Kemp sees that, and he's going to get in front of Casey Cagle on it and say, I was the first to call for a clean adoption bill, and look what happened.
Well, I think one thing that happened is that Secretary Kemp woke up that morning when he decided to actually come out and call for a clean adoption bill. He realized that every voter in the state of Georgia is not just a Republican voter. I think this was a clear opportunity for him to take the lead, to Greg's point, to start appealing to independents. But, you know, me, Greg, and Ty, we're down at the Capitol every single day. And let's not forget, this is a bill that hasn't really been reanalyzed in over almost two decades. And so we all agree, mm-hmm. Democrats and Republicans, that we've got to really look at the actual language and the intent of the bill and make sure that the amendment that was offered by the state senator, which it was on a path to actually being, you know, I think passed by both chambers, but it was when the state senator introduced some very discriminatory language that clearly discriminates against LGBT people and couples, that is where you saw the bill derail. But I think this is a big move by Brian Kemp, and I think that he can definitely take a lot of credit for being the first to speak out against.
I disagree with Theron's characterization of the bill, but I'm going to leave that for the moment and say this. I don't know that there is a smooth path through the Senate for a clean bill, because the reason this tied everything up near the end of the session was there were enough senators who might vote for it within the Republican caucus to make it something that they couldn't risk a floor fight on. And that's not the kind of issue where I think the members who would have voted for it then, I don't know how many of them will have changed their mind. And the fellow who introduced the amendment, I saw him picking up pictures of him on Facebook picking up a Legislator of the Year award from one of the largest conservative religious organizations in the state over the weekend. I don't know that there's an easy path.
All right, so if they don't get a clean bill out, and if conservative Republicans make enough of a fuss about having a bill that gives agencies the right to refuse same-sex couples adoptions, tomorrow I can already see the Democratic TV spots with unfortunate orphan children or babies and the voiceover saying these kids need a home and Republicans are playing religious politics.
Yeah, absolutely.
I guess that's all you can say.
Yeah, and I think that, listen, I mean, I don't, you know, Todd and I are really good friends, and, you know, we don't want to waste everyone's time getting into a very wonkish debate about the language in the bill.
But we're fixing to, it sounds like.
But I think to your point, Bill, is that what Brian Kemp just did, I think that he saw, okay, everyone has been, you know, moved to the right. I mean, they had to sign pledges to support a version. I want to make sure if Brian Robinson were here, he would say that, a version of a religious liberty freedom bill. But more importantly, I mean, I think that Republicans do not want to give Democrats an opportunity to put those ads up at a time where a lot of these folks are going to be on the ballot for reelection and elections around the state. So, you know, I think that ultimately you're going to see some bipartisan support for this bill and ultimately get a clean, non-discriminatory bill passed.
All right, which is, I assume, well, I won't even go there because I recognize that my comments are charged, but I mean, it's certainly in the interest of children if more people can adopt, so we'll see how that plays out. All right, we got to get a break in. When we come back, we are going to talk about what's going on in terms of the Senate tax bill, where things stand in terms of late concessions or who's still intransigent about this thing. And we're going to talk about the Atlanta mayor's race and about the debate we had yesterday, among many other things. But in the meantime, this is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Financial contributions from listeners like you are not the only gifts that keep GPB on the air. In fact, many listeners have already chosen to donate a used vehicle to GPB. We'll pick up your vehicle for free and send you the paperwork for your taxes. Get started today. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or go to gpb.org/cars. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
We're back on Political Rewind. Tamar Hellerman joins us from the Washington Cox Bureau. She's the AJC political reporter on the Hill. Theron Johnson is with us. Todd Rehm and Greg Bluestein is here as well. One quick note. You may have seen this morning, if you pay attention to Trump's Twitter feed, that he retweeted some violent images that are videos that the person who tweeted them, essentially Jada Franson, who is the one of the leaders of an ultra-nationalist group in Britain, purporting to show violence by Muslims against non-Muslims. And they've already caused a great deal of controversy, but they're guaranteed to cause even more because we now have a message from David Duke, the former neo-Nazi, saying that he applauds President Trump for pointing out violence against Muslims. Is that tweet getting any talk up on the Hill tomorrow?
Oh, sure. Every reporter is asking every senator about it, but none of them want to talk.
Yeah.
There's been some who have said, you know, it's not right, he shouldn't be doing this. You know, the Jeff Flakes of the world who have announced their retirement, but others are trying to run as far away from this as quickly as possible.
It just strikes me, this is, Greg, another example of the president getting in the way of his own agenda. Tamar's up there covering tax reform. The Senate is working like crazy to try to get a bill passed so they can show they've done something this year. And the president stirs things up with a tweet, retweeting these violent images, which may or may not be authentic, only a couple days after calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas once again in a ceremony honoring the Navajo code talkers. He just, for better or worse, can't stop stepping on his own message.
Yeah, and by the way, the White House said it doesn't even matter if these videos are authentic. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, Trump's spokeswoman, said the threat is real, the threat needs to be addressed, the threat has to be talked about. So she essentially said that it doesn't matter if these are fabricated, if these are staged videos. And that in the same time, British Prime Minister Theresa May, he's picked a fight with her because she roundly condemned Trump for promoting these videos as well.
I think more and more every day that these constant distractions are part of the way they're doing business, because what it has also done is, if the reporters are running around asking a bunch of questions about these videos, they're not asking questions about the current status of the Senate finance bill, and they're not locking down members on whether they're going to vote for it or against it. And it buys some breathing room, actually, for Senate leadership to have discussions within their caucus.
Go ahead, Tamar. No, and at the same time, we've seen with Trump that the group that he cares most about is his base.
Yeah.
And tweets like this rile up the base. And so it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks.
And I think it's also distracting us away from the fact that Republicans have a very hotly contested race in Alabama, in which Donald Trump is trying to come out more and more for Roar Moore. But also just really, again, to Tamar's point, firing up a base that he hopefully will turn out and try to bring one more against the finish line. So, you know, this is something that we've just seen every single week almost from this president. But I agree with Todd that it's definitely a method to his madness. Don't think that he just wakes up and says, hey, I want to retweet this because I have nothing else to do. I mean, he is linked to this group and these groups' intentions. And if for David Duke to retweet him and congratulate him shows that connection still exists.
And he's making us reporters perfect our multitasking skills, because we have to ask lots of different questions about lots of different stories these days.
But it's true. Every minute that we're writing about these tweets are minutes that we're not writing about substantive issues like the tax bill. I mean,
well, let me ask you. Okay, so this isn't, today's not a show we're going to do about the media. But as long as you mention that, Tamar, to what extent do reporters, and I'm not asking, I guess I am sort of asking you to talk about your own work up there. To what extent are you free to chase the story that seems to you to be a more substantive one, and to what extent are you under pressure, maybe not from editors, but just seeing what your colleagues are filing, to go with the flow?
I'm lucky that in this job I get a lot of freedom to kind of pursue what I want. But especially when Trump first was sworn in, it felt like you had to cover the controversy of the day.
Right.
One thing I am seeing with my colleagues on Capitol Hill is that an issue like tax reform is so hard to understand. It's so hard for us to grasp. You know, they haven't done this in 30 years. It's not exactly the easiest issue to pick up and write about. But writing about the latest controversy of the day, that's easy. So you see a lot of people pulled in that direction.
I get that. I get that completely. We have found it very difficult to figure out how to talk about tax reform. I've said it over and over again. This is like a partisan Rorschach test. You can hear Democrats will take the same bill and talk about what a disgrace it is for middle class and poorer Americans that Republicans insist is making the lives of those same people better. So it's a tough one to grasp.
And I think the fact that we haven't seen something like this since the 80s is also why I think a lot of the folks in Washington writing about this don't have a frame of reference for how long and how arduous something like this really is. It took months and months and months and dramatic leadership by Democrats to move Reagan's bill forward. It was an epic legislative battle back in the 80s. And to think that this is something that one house or the other can dispatch within a couple weeks I think a lot of folks who are looking to get this finished by Christmas break or by New Year's are going to be disappointed when we're still dealing with this.
Yeah, but the challenge,
July.
Todd, that we've been hearing about a tax reform bill since really, and I'm going to be fair, I would say probably late February, early March. And so the problem with this president and the Republican leadership is their inability to stay on task and stay disciplined to actually try to get things done. And so I think, yeah, it is hard. It's going to take a while. But, I mean, we've been waiting for something that's going to be fair to the American people to come out since March. And I agree with you. I don't think they're going to be able to get it done before the end of the year.
Tamar, the Politico this morning released a poll from Morning Consult, who they're partnering with for a lot of their polling, that shows that support for the House plan, even while the Senate's, which they passed, of course, even while the Senate's debating or getting set to debate their plan, is eroding. Morning Consult finds that while Republicans, for the most part, support the plan, support's dropped to 59% from 66%, and GOP opposition grew several points, and undecideds grew a little bit, too. While the Senate's trying to figure out a way to get everybody on board, are they listening? Are voters sending them messages that they'd better be careful?
I mean, judging from the stuff that I get CC'd on Twitter, I mean, people are paying attention for sure. But I think, you know, Republican senators have made the calculation that it's, you know, it's kind of all or everything here. They weren't able to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, and they're so terrified that they won't have something to show voters that they accomplished for 2018 that they're kind of putting everything else aside and really focusing on this.
Yeah, that does seem to be the motivating force here, Greg. Passing a bill to show they've accomplished something, especially for the wealthier donors to Republican candidates.
And many lawmakers are upfront about it. They said they need a win, period. And after a year of a lot of tumult in Capitol Hill and very slow-moving legislation and the failure to repeal Obamacare and some other big-ticket items like the immigration crackdown and the border wall and other things, senators and House members are very upfront about it. They need this.
So tomorrow we're still in a situation, as we are with a lot of the measures, certainly with repeal and replace, where two defectors from the Republican Party will kill the measure. And the party did have a success in the Finance Committee the other day when both Bob Corker of Tennessee, who has not been exactly the biggest friend of the president, and Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, who has expressed a lot of concerns about this bill, both of them on the Finance Committee voted to move it out. Should that tell us that they are moving toward supporting it? It makes the bill more possible? Or are they just saying, yeah, we want to give everybody a shot at this?
I think it's looking like McConnell has won them over. You know, they claim, those two senators claim they got handshake agreements to make certain changes in the bill. And I think as long as those changes stay in, they seem to be okay with it. The issue now is the blowback to some of those agreements, particularly to win over Bob Corker, who's a big deficit hawk. Mitch McConnell had to agree to what are called triggers. So basically, if the if the bill doesn't generate as much revenue as initially expected, it would raise taxes. Mm-hmm. That's freaking out a ton of interest groups. And there's concern that the bill might lose support from Republicans because of that addition for Senator Corker. So that's kind of the Rubik's Cube, as Mitch McConnell described yesterday, and the calculations that are going into it as they try to get to a final vote.
Theron, Republicans may win this battle. They may get their bill through the Senate, and they may... the president's pushing them to get the House to just agree to this, to get agreement without going into conference committee. But the political reality is that this will hit in 2018. The consequence, a victory now does not assure a smooth road as Republicans run for re-election and voters see what this bill may or may not accomplish.
No, and I mean, I think Republicans are in the same position that Democrats were in 2010. I mean, at that time, we had elected a very popular president. It was a tremendous moment in our American history, but Democrats had to go back to their districts and defend Obamacare. They had to talk about all the things that were going on in Washington. So to your point, Bill, yes. I mean, if they get this done before the end of the year, that would be a big win for them. But also, Republicans have got to go back home and run for re-election in primaries, by the way, but even before they get to the general and really try to hang their hat on something.
And one of the questions, and Tamar mentioned this, is what are the interest groups going to say about this? What is a Grover Norquist going to say? Is he going to say that if you vote for something with automatic triggers, that you're in effect voting for a tax increase? And so that's what... If that's the linchpin upon which this all hangs, I think it's going to get a lot more complicated before anything gets passed, because the idea of voting for anything that has automatic tax increases, having to run with that on your record for a congressman, for a senator, it's unthinkable. And I think if you see some of these organizations start to talk back on that particular point, I think it's going to be rough.
All right, we're going to watch. Tomorrow, you're going to have a busy couple of days up there, clearly.
No kidding.
All right, let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way, because we have a lot to say about what happened in the Atlanta mayoral debate yesterday. There was news this morning that we need to catch you all up on that'll affect, we think, probably will have some impact on the race. So let's get to that after we take this short break.
On the next Fresh Air.
Ladies and gentlemen, the 45th and final President of the United States.
We hear from the two stars of the Comedy Central series, The President Show, Anthony Atamanik, who plays President Trump, and Peter Gross, who plays Vice President Pence. The show is like a late-night talk show hosted by the president with the vice president as a sidekick. Join us.
Fresh Air, 3 o'clock this afternoon, here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We're joined today by Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the AJC. Real quick, we haven't asked you, what are you working on for tomorrow? What are we going to see your byline attached to?
I'm working on a story about the mayor and Keisha Lance Bottoms' campaign. You haven't heard him be quite as vocal in the last few days. It seems like he's sort of giving her a little more space.
We'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes. Todd Rehm, Republican consultant, is with us, and also the editor of GeorgiaPundit.com. Theron Johnson, Democratic insider, consultant. And in Washington, Tamar Hallerman, the AJC's Washington correspondent. Greg, let me start with you on this. We had an hour debate here between Bottoms and Norwood. It was your friend Jim Galloway, Monica Pearson, and I who talked to the candidates. You wrote a story about this for the Politically Georgia blog, and essentially you focused on a couple of things that you thought came out of it that mattered. One of them was an exchange we'll play a bit of in a second in which Keisha Bottoms and Mary Norwood went back and forth about how Mary Norwood was characterizing some of those in the African-American community.
Yeah, and the exchange centered on a previously unreleased recording that she made in June to a Buckhead Young Republicans group, where she alleged that Kasim Reed, and we're sitting with his campaign manager from that 2009 race, but the Kasim Reed's campaign engaged in widespread voter fraud in that 2009 race that helped him beat Mary Norwood. And she said she did not want to air that publicly, but she was happy to talk about it privately. Well, that recording was released, and in that recording, she said she used words like thugs, and some other language that Keisha Lance Bottom said in that debate was coded language meant to discriminate against African Americans.
I want to play a good portion of that. And Theron, when we come out of it, I want you to comment on what you think this means.
The coded language was related to African Americans who exercise their lawful right to vote. And my opponent, in a secret tape, disparage lawful voters, African-American voters.
I would love to hear you two talk about this a little more, because it's clearly a big issue.
This is important. No, this is important. This is very important. Let me be very clear. When I was on the Board of Elections, it was presented to the Elections Board 111 people who crossed over jurisdictional lines to go back and vote from a public housing address that no longer existed. And I, as a member of that board, said, I do not want to prosecute these people. I will vote no to go after these individuals. And I turned to Dr. Durley and I said, Dr. Durley, it was not the nice people who had moved to an apartment with a voucher outside the city who I consider having done something. They are not the culprit. The culprit was whoever found the housing authority list and went to them and said, we need you to come back in and vote on Tuesday. You used to live at this address.
You called
them thugs. Need you. We need you, someone who goes to an apartment and coerces an individual to come back in and vote illegally. Ms. Bottoms, that is not a nice person.
Did you use the word thug? Did you call them thugs?
Ms. Bottom, your coding and my coding are different.
Did you call them thugs?
Ms. Bottoms?
Did you call them thugs?
Thugs does not mean African-American, Ms. Bottoms. Thug means unethical behavior. And it is unethical for someone to coerce a nice person of whatever background, whatever nationality, and to coerce them into committing a crime in order to affect the outcome of a vote.
Theron?
Wow. So let me give a little historical aspect for our viewers. And so, yeah, I did run Mayor Reed's successful campaign in 2009. We beat Mary Norwood by 714 votes. As you guys may remember, I actually had to postpone my much planned, vacation because Mary Norwood demanded a recount. Yeah. And in that recount, she only picked up one vote. So we went from 715 votes to 714. Mary Norwood had an opportunity at that time to publicly come out and say, hey, 100-plus people voted in this election illegally. She did not do that. All right? So Mary goes on to become mayor. But we've heard, Bill, from 8 years, I've heard that Mary Norwood has gone all around this city. She's met with Republican consultants, Democratic consultants, Republican elected officials, Democratic elected officials, and has really put this Trumpian narrative out there that we stole the election. So my point is this. If Mary Norwood felt so strongly that 111 or so people actually illegally voted in the 2009 election, then why didn't she come forward and actually say, hey, I want to make sure this is investigated? And let's not forget, this is the same Mary Norwood who failed to qualify to run for Fulton County Commission chair because she forgot the deadline. And so this is a woman who I agree has just basically been trying to really give this coded whistle, kind of talk to white voters. Now, let me get into the thugs. I heard the audio. I think everyone around the table heard the audio. Not only did she refer to these African-American people as thugs, She referred to them as welfare abusers. She referred to them as felons. And then what she says in the audio, this is just so damning, is that she actually says, please don't record this. If this got out, oh my God, this could be really bad for me. And she said that it's her secret weapon. This is the one thing that I'm going to basically be able to win this election with. So this is another flawed candidate in Mary Norwood, basically having an unforced error when really put to task to ask what she did. So I think this is definitely going to really hurt her
right,
campaign.
But given all that, Todd Rehm, excuse me again, it is Mary Norwood who's picking up some significant African-American endorsements. She just got the endorsement of former Mayor Shirley Franklin the other day. Cesar Mitchell, city council president, is in her corner. So
John Eves she got as well.
That's right. John Eves. So clearly, Todd, not everyone is as concerned as Theron is about her, what seems to be code talk.
Well, if you ever want to know, if you ever want to push Theron's buttons, we now know what to bring up to get him to go off. You know, that one of the things about Mayor Reed is that people have very strong visceral reactions to him. Some of them, it's the strong visceral reaction that Theron has that makes him want to defend Mayor Reed. You know, he'd crawl over broken glass for the mayor, I suspect. And I'm not saying that, but for those who don't like Mayor Reed, they have that same visceral reaction, I think. And Mayor Franklin is one of those people who you've seen her. She hasn't really let out the war cry of any sort, but over the last like 12 or 18 months, you've seen her get increasingly critical, sometimes, you know, soft peddling criticism of the way Mayor Reed conducts himself. Not so much, and she criticizes the way he's done the job too, but a lot of it is about his personality being so polarizing. But I want to say this, and everybody in the studio here, I know we all speak to groups all the time. And so do this exercise for me. Next time you're speaking to a group, hold up your hands and say, please don't record this, and see how many people reach for their phones and start the voice memo.
Yeah, let me change the subject just slightly, Greg. This morning, Kathy, she got the endorsement, Mary Norwood got the endorsement of Kathy Woolard, who finished third in the race with a significant share of votes. I mean, what, around
17%.
Okay. So, you know, with Mayor Franklin the other day, with John Eves the other day, with Kathy Woolard the other day, is there any momentum heading Mary Norwood's way? Fox 5 put out a poll saying the race is essentially a dead heat, although I haven't seen crosstab. We don't know much about the methodology of the poll, so we don't know how accurate it might be.
I can say, I mean, Mary Norwood's campaign was ecstatic. They were here yesterday when they got the news about that poll, and I saw their unbridled emotion about it. They thought, I think, they were going to be a little bit further behind, and to see a statistical dead heat, 41-39, I think, was the poll numbers. They were very pumped about it. Mary Norwood, Kathy Woolard's support is another big, huge get for them. They feel like Shirley Franklin's endorsement gave sort of African American Democrats permission to vote for someone. That's their view. You know, Democrats, seeing a leading Democrat of the state, seeing someone who is the co-chair of the DNC's platform committee endorse someone who has been castigated as a closet Republican, might give a few more African Americans.
All right. I need to change the subject because we've only got a couple other items we really want to cover before we run out of time. One of them I want to talk to you about tomorrow. The Congressional Black Caucus has announced that they're not going to push John Conyers to resign from Congress. What does it look like up there in terms of Conyers having, I mean, he's got some support from the caucus right now, but how serious has this become for him?
It's become incredibly serious, but at the same time, it's a very awkward matter on the Democratic side. You know, John Conyers is a civil rights hero. He's been around for a very long time. People are so, you know, conscious of how they don't want to step on his legacy. So while I feel like privately a lot of them want him to step down, You know, they don't want to say that publicly. You're starting to see a few now, and perhaps we'll see more in the coming days. But it's kind of an awkward situation.
The other thing that's coming up there, I believe, is that there are increasing calls for to expose this what sounds like a slush fund to pay off harassment, not just sexual harassment, but any kind of harassment, quietly and privately at some $15 or so million, I think, Tamar.
Yeah, over the last few years. And it's the sort of thing where this is taxpayer-funded money.
Okay, so that story continues and will probably not go away anytime soon. One other thing that we should all talk about. I'm not even quite sure what to make of this story, Todd Rehm. So there was a woman who the AJC has kind of investigated and determined she lived in Atlanta at some point, who tried to convince a Washington Post reporter that that Roy Moore had fathered a child by her when she was a teenager. The Washington Post did not publish the story because they couldn't verify it in any way. They were suspicious. And this woman may, in fact, have been an agent for Project Veritas, which we know over the years has really tried to expose what they call sort of liberal individuals and organizations. And the notion was that if the Post went with the story, Project Veritas would be able to discredit the Post, all of the Post reporting about Roy Moore and sex harassment.
It's a fascinating story. I read it when I first saw it, and the first thing that stuck out in my mind was this was really amateur hour.
Mm-hmm. All of their efforts are amateur hour.
Yeah,
but some of them work. This one didn't.
Right.
But it's one thing when you're going up against, you know, volunteers in an ideological organization or something like that. It's another to walk into the belly of the beast with a yarn that you're trying to sell them.
And a GoFundMe page you haven't deleted that says exactly what you're setting out to do.
And I mean, I can see the journalist being angry that somebody wasted their time this way. And then, you know, just spending a little time online realizing this is really a fascinating story. And you know, we can't let this go. It was just a fascinating story. And the what's been more interesting is when I saw Fox News picked it up, you know, sort of the opposite end of the ideological spectrum within the business, it's still an industry that sticks together at
yeah.
some level.
Well, maybe it does. Theron and Roy Moore continues to look like he has the potential to win this race on December 12th.
Yeah, I mean, it's just really interesting with all the, you know, the accusations and the stories that I hear these women tell and just the crimes. Let's just not, you know, sugarcoat this. I mean, these are certain things that he's done that can actually be prosecuted. The fact that he's actually still has an opportunity to win this race, I think Lori Geary, when she was on the show with me a week or so ago, and we talked about this, is that it's the difference between an American voter, but it's also an Alabama voter. And that the Alabama voters may have not really liked a lot of people coming into their state and telling them who they should vote for to be their U.S. senator. But I think Democrats are definitely still very optimistic that we have a chance to win. And I know that a lot of people have left Georgia going over to Alabama to campaign in these next few weeks for that seat. So we'll just have to see what happens.
And that's a danger, too, in a way. I mean, I'm heading back out there next week, too, to report on it more. But that's a concern, too, because, you know, Alabama Democrats and Republicans are wary of outsiders. Yeah. You know, people coming in, especially from the Yankees coming in and trying to tell them what to do and raising money and spending. So even the state Democratic Party is trying to quietly say, you know, we don't need your help knocking on doors, but we really need is your money, and maybe, you know, you can help do with making phone calls here
and
there.
Well, and apparently the reports this week, speaking of money, Doug Jones has outspent Roy Moore by millions of dollars. He's raised millions for TV ads. Roy Moore has spent apparently about $800,000 on TV ads. And one of the problems, the reasons for that is the NRSC, the National Republican Senate Committee, and the RNC both pulled out. So he's having a hard time raising money. But in this case, maybe TV isn't going to hurt him that much.
Well, and at some level, it's a similar dynamic to the 6th District that we saw up here in that money and television advertising will go only so far. It'll take you a long way, But there's a level at which it just won't get you to. And I want to say that I think part of what you're seeing among voters in Alabama is that a lot of the Roy Moore allegations play into negative stereotypes that are typically expressed against Alabamans, against Georgians, against Southerners. And I think some of it is reaction to that, of those stories coming out of Washington and hitting those negative stereotypes.
Right. We're fast running out of time. I want to throw one thing to you, Tamara, and ask you to respond to it. We are told by several news organizations that President Trump has been talking widely to friends and associates about his conviction that the Mueller probe is going to definitely be over with by the end of 2017. What do you think about that?
I think that's a little optimistic. It sounds like, reading all the reporting, it sounds like Mueller is really kind of peeling the onion, and he's got so many more layers to go before he gets to the center, Trump. I don't see him stopping anytime soon, but who knows?
Anybody else want to take a crack at that? This isn't going to end by January. Theron Johnson's shaking his head.
No, I mean, I think it's widespread. And I think, again, Donald Trump uses the ability to try to deflect and really put out sort of fake expectations and fake news on things that he makes these bold predictions on. So I think that this investigation is going to go on for a while.
But isn't there a lesson that we should have learned from the interminable Ken Starr investigation into Bill Clinton, that at some point, yeah, you can keep going, but you just stop getting traction at some point?
Yeah, well, I do think one thing that could be smart, not that he's necessarily thinking strategically, he may be, about this. If you keep saying this enough times, and if it gets picked up in more and more places, then when it does continue to go on and on, he creates a mindset in among his base that, hey, what's going on here? This thing was supposed to be wrapped up. There might be something kind of cagey about this.
Yeah, I mean, an effort to sort of discredit what they're doing and saying that they ran out of room and they're just scrambling to find something on them.
All right. We have gone through almost every topic that was on our list today. We didn't get to every single one, but we never do. And we're now out of time. I'm really happy with the conversation we were able to have today. Tamar Hallerman, thanks for making the walk over from the Capitol to the Cox Studios there on 400 North Capitol. It's always fun to have you on the show. Good luck the rest of this week.
Thanks so much.
Theron Johnson, are you fired up about the mayor's election this
week? I am.
Week?
Yeah, I'm actually going to go and vote early so I don't keep getting all these calls and mail pieces and telling me to go vote.
Right. Todd Rehm, thank you for being here as well. We look forward to continuing having you back. We're really glad you're back and able to be with us more often. And Greg Bluestein, you're going to be back with me on Friday.
I will.
Who knows what we'll be talking about by Friday, but there's no question there will be news. It may very well be that the Senate has voted on the tax reform bill, and we'll find out where we stand on that. So thanks for joining us today.
No problem.
Thanks, of course, to our team, to Olivia Rheingold, to Tyler Morris, and to Tom Faust for their work on the show. I'm Bill Nigut. We will be we'll be here tomorrow for Two Way Street, and our guest is the infectiously gregarious Lynn Rosetto Casper, the 22-year host of The Splendid Table. She can talk about anything and make it fascinating. You just throw a couple words her way. Wait till you hear her talk about Pappy Van Winkle, bourbon, and about quinoa. That's tomorrow on Two-Way Street at 2. Then we'll see you Friday for Political Rewind at 3. Take care.